You can have
it. I will definitely, you know, I am a collect all the vitamins and minerals I possibly can so well, that I can stay healthy. I'm going to try to TN in.
I try to be discretionary about it, but it can't hurt. You know, green tea's been used. Maybe I should just start drinking green tea instead of coffee, I guess. That would probably be good.
I heard that that's a better option, so I'm going to
You're off mic, so there we go. All right. Speaking of immigration, I got a half hour from Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, with about three different people talking about immigration and family unification, and not unifying them in a detention center with deplorable conditions, which we've heard really ghastly stories about. If you're listening, if you're looking away, I can understand it, but we need to look at it. It's about a half hour altogether. They're in pledge drive mode, and I think I've got this edited so that we don't hear them calling for support. But as long as I'm on that subject, why don't I read this? We're supposed to read this once a show. We at WEFT have recently been informed of an issue with our broadcast tower. To stay on the air, we have to make plans to relocate our antenna and transmitter in the next few months, costing approximately $50,000, an unanticipated expense that really kind of comes up right where our annual budget is. So if you're interested in helping this community keep this community treasure operational, you can do so in a variety of ways. Join WEFT as an individual member at WEFT. Talk to your friends about it. That's ad-libbing there. If you're a business, become an underwriter of WEFT programming. If you know of possible grants and other types of funding, share that information with us. Or even partner with WEFT on your next fundraiser. WEFT can provide manpower and free promotion. For more information, send an email to stationmanager@weft.org. There's a committee that's looking at that. And as always, stay tuned to 90.1 FM. And so I've been with the show News from Neptune for a while. I've been basically listening to alternative sources, and it gets really intense when things that are commonplaces in the mainstream media, focuses, and otherwise are just so ubiquitous and so easily to undermine, actually, in a lot of ways. The Skripal case, the poisoning in UK, is just falling apart, but no one wants to examine the debris of this story. It's really pretty crazy. You don't have to be an apologist for Putin to say that a fair accusation ought to be justified. And Craig Murray, who's doing a lot of great writing on this, says that he makes an analogy, doesn't explicitly say it's like a police officer saying, well, round up the usual suspects. Who would we expect to do this? And that's just Russian to judgment was one of his original essays on the subject. So the other thing I have is also pretty, well, more controversial because it has to do with Julian Assange, who's been basically blockaded from the press. He's a lot of things, people are saying things about he and WikiLeaks, and he has apparently no right of reply at the Ecuadorian embassy. There's 60 hours of streaming of testimonials and a variety of people. You can find it online. I believe it's Justice for Assange. I'll have more details on that. I'm sure you can find it without too much searching. I think it would be good to dip into that because everyone has foibles, but the great work that he has done in revealing stuff about the national security state, I think is really seminal, and it's still having impacts to this day. So fellow Australian John Pilger, who mainly hangs his hat in the UK, a very prolific filmmaker, a friend of Assange's, and I like to mention that he wrote the article about, well, a relatively recent article about the CIA-engineered coup in Australia in the mid-70s. We think of the CIA doing machinations and interventions, a variety of electoral and regime change types in the darker nations, as it were, the lesser developed countries, the third world. But to an Australian leftist, the CIA looks quite a bit different because it brought down a government in their own country. So I think that's an important thing for United States citizens to take on board when they think about Assange's motives, etc. Not a minion of the Kremlin. When helped Bradley Manning, Chelsea Manning, reveal stuff. Okay, I usually kick it off with some Mumia Abu-Jamal, but I think I'm going to short shrift him today. He doesn't have a topical commentary. He has a section from his most recent book that he co-authored recently. He's doing a lot of excerpts and book chats and is busy promoting it. There's also, if you go to prisonradio.org, you can find out about his upcoming legal processes. There are things working in his case. Still, after so many years in jail, Amy Goodman's got a piece about a Mexican journalist, freedom of the press. So I guess I'm going to go to that and set up the rest of the show. I may have time for the aforementioned Greg Palast, sort of an archival nugget that I've found that I may get to. Needs a fair amount of introduction, so I'm not sure I really will have time to put it on. Look through the community events. It is kind of dog days of summer are back upon us. So I'm not sure how much the calendar is full, but here's Amy Goodman breaking the sound barrier again. Okay.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Emilio Gutierrez Soto, a journalist who fled certain assassination in his native Mexico, has just been released from an immigrant detention center in Texas. He and his son Oscar were detained by ICE, that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement, last December, 2 months after Emilio received an award from the National Press Club, where he publicly denounced the asylum process. Last week, a federal judge ordered both Emilio and Oscar released, noting evidence suggested Emilio was targeted by ICE for speaking out. Gutierrez Soto's case is emblematic of the cruelty of President Donald Trump's crackdown on immigrants and asylum seekers, as well as Trump's increasingly vitriolic disdain for the free press. In 2005, Emilio wrote a series of articles documenting corruption in the Mexican army in his home state of Chihuahua. He refused to stop reporting and in 2008 received an urgent call from a friend who'd heard that Emilio was about to be killed. Emilio grabbed his vital documents and his 14-year-old son and fled for the U.S. border. Emilio and Oscar were detained for several months upon arrival, then released as his asylum claim made its way through the lengthy process. Speaking at the awards ceremony at the National Press Club in October of 2017, Emilio said,
"En el 99% de los casos de asesinatos, desapariciones y exilios, es el dolor constante en nuestras familias."
99% of the murder cases, the disappearances and the exiles is a constant suffering and source of pain for our families.
Doña Impunidad no nos ha dejado de la mano.
Impunity has not let go of our hand.
Mientras la justicia, Doña Justicia, se prostituye acompañada del Estado.
While Lady Justice prostitutes herself in the company of the government.
Los medios, perdón. Para rematar, la libertad de expresión
to again kill the freedom of expression.
Quienes buscamos asilo político en países como este,
those who seek political asylum in countries like this, like the United States,
nos encontramos con la cerrazón de autoridades migratorias.
We encounter the decisions of immigration authorities
que regatean las leyes internacionales,
that barter away the international laws.
2 months later, Emilio and Oscar were arrested. The National Press Club's executive director, Bill McCarron, immediately began advocating for Emilio and his son Oscar. He went to El Paso with Congressmember Beto O'Rourke to meet with ICE. McCarron said he was told to tone it down by ICE's local general counsel, Elias Castello. McCarron took that to mean they should be less public in their campaign to support Emilio. During the 7 months of ICE detention, Emilio witnessed firsthand President Trump's cruel immigration crackdown.
The way of life in that concentration camp is extremely harsh. What the immigration authorities seek is to finish you off psychologically, and we're trying to resume our lives in liberty, in semi-liberty.
That's Emilio Gutierrez Soto speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour on Wednesday, just days after U.S. District Judge David Guadarrama ordered his release. Emilio recounted the anguish he shared with the many parents in detention with him, separated from their children, not knowing if they would ever see them again. More than 700 children still remain separated from their parents. While Emilio is optimistic following the election of Andrés Manuel López Obrador as Mexico's new president, he remains critical of the current Mexican government.
The Mexican consulate in El Paso is an agency that is totally at the service of ICE. It does not protect the interests of Mexicans at all. It takes great pleasure in being friends with William Joyce, who's the field director of ICE.
While Emilio and Oscar are out of detention, they're still under supervision of ICE's internal security.
We hope that in coming days, the immigration authorities, particularly ICE, will return to us our social security cards and the other documents that they confiscated from us.
In addition to receiving the National Press Club's Press Freedom Award, Emilio was also just named a Knight Wallace Journalism Fellow by the University of Michigan. He's expected to be at the Ann Arbor campus on August 27th, but fears ICE is delaying the release of his documents, preventing him from traveling to punish him.
We have such a moral commitment on our part, particularly my son and myself, to raise awareness and foster greater solidarity among human beings as a way of strengthening our peoples, our education, and our social conduct. We have a lot of work to do still. I have a lot to write.
Emilio Gutierrez Soto and his now 24-year-old son, Oscar, deserve political asylum. Emilio might have been another statistic, one of scores of Mexican journalists killed in the line of duty, but he survived by fleeing to the United States. His hard-earned perspective is needed as a new day dawns in Mexico and anti-immigrant prejudice consumes the White House. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Well said. As I said, we're going to turn to immigration. There are a lot of issues I could fulminate about. It's so surreal. It's sort of... hard to keep your head spinning if you follow the news. I'm still a skeptic of major impact by Russian intervention. Clearly, there were things going on, but I'm still skeptical that it had much to do with the outcome. Not to say that it shouldn't be stopped, but if you listen to The Intercept, which didn't have an episode this week, but this guy from Washington State, Ro Khan, that's not his, he's a freshman, but he's got a bill that's going to be attached, or I guess it was deleted from the defense spending bill, because we know that that huge defense spending, quote, defense spending has been passed. But to just say it's the sense of the Congress that the U.S. shouldn't interfere with other nations' elections, like we're doing right now in Cambodia, apparently. So I may have time for something terribly controversial right at the very end, but maybe I'll save it for another day when I can frame it a little better. I hope you're coping all right, despite everything, and sitting comfortably. And here's a good half hour on immigration issues from Flashpoints. As he says right at the top, they've been focused on it all week, and you can find flashpoints.net. It's an easy way to get there. Weft KPFA archives. Audio port wasn't working today. I was trying to find something fresh by Palace talking about 2/3 of a million voters being disqualified in Georgia. I wonder if some names from Illinois through cross-check were used to disqualify. He's got evidence that they were disqualifying people that had different middle names just because they felt they needed to win the election. Okay, return to the separation, brutal separation of children.
Laser on these children. And to do that, to help us do that, we're joined by Alex Mensing, who's with Sin Fronteras, who has been back and forth across the frontier on this side of the border and on the other side of the border, watching very closely, working with parents of these busted up families based on Trump's new program, expanded program of ethnic cleansing. Alex, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me on the show, Dennis.
Well, it's good to have you with us. Today is the day all the kids are supposed to be returned. What can you tell us about what it's looking like? I'm thinking that the administration did not keep their word, to say the least.
Unfortunately, no. Yet again, in an extremely, extremely frustrating series of events, the administration has not managed to do that. They've completely failed to provide any sort of peace or any sort of reunification. There are three families who we've been following very closely who came in the refugee caravan. One of the mothers, Elena, spoke on the last show that you had me on, and I just spoke to her a little while ago, and I asked her how she's feeling, and she feels deceived. She feels deceived by the administration for having promised, after creating a crisis, manufacturing a crisis by taking all these children from the parents, and then under extreme pressure, finally agreeing to give them back, and then not doing it on multiple occasions. Her husband, the father of the child who was separated from them, is still in Port Isabel Detention Center in Texas. He is still not being given information. He's been continually told he's in the process. He's in a process to wait one more day, that they're investigating, to look for criminal records to see what they can do to reunite them. And there's no clear answers, and there's definitely been no concrete action taken to reunify that family, nor the other two who we've been speaking with.
And in terms of the administration and their, what are they saying now in terms of the fact that they haven't met the deadline given by a federal judge? What's the word now?
They continue to provide excuses that fall into their anti-immigrant narrative. They talk about criminal records. They talk about fitness of being parents. They talk about whether or not it's in the best interest of the child. And in some cases, unfortunately, they say it's out of our hands because they've been deported. Or they say, well, the child is already out with a different family member, so why would we release the parent? These are all things that are clearly not acceptable, given neither the court order nor any sort of human dignity, nor any sort of human justice. Then they're using this as an opportunity to continue criminalizing and victimizing immigrant families who have come here, in many cases, to seek asylum. And they're trying to make them look like gang members. They're trying to make them look like unfit parents who are coming here to somehow attack a country, when really they're fleeing a situation due to an attack by the United States on Central America. And because of the long, long history of U.S. intervention, not only in Central America, but in Mexico, and we're seeing a series of new concerns with enforcement in Mexico that I hope doesn't lead to similar policies of family separation there.
Now, just in terms of some kind of bottom line, what do we know about the numbers? We've heard 3,000 children were taken. We've heard even more than that were taken. We heard that something like 80 or 100, the administration say 80 or 100 can't be returned because of various circumstances. What's the bottom line on the numbers?
What I know about the numbers for the total numbers is that it's much, much more than just 3,000, because people are just focusing on this kind of recent wave of children who were taken from their parents. But if you look at family separation really at face value for what it is, the U.S. government has been separating families for many, many years, not only kids taken from their parents. They don't even count U.S. citizen children who are taken from parents who may have gone back to their home country with them and then have to flee later on. They've been taking them away for a very long time. So there are many cases that the government's not counting in the total number. And the number of people who have continued to not be reunited continually changes. I haven't been able to keep up with the last couple of days, but it was several hundred recently. And I know of many organizations that are continuing to battle with the cases that they're working on. And we've had about half of the cases that we knew about have been reunified, and the other half continue to meet with this bureaucratic wall that is accompanied by this anti-immigrant hateful rhetoric.
And I have a question. I know that there's a lot of actions being planned against these policies up here in Northern California. Can you let us know what's going on in Southern California, in San Ysidro, near the border? What's going on in terms of people trying to fight this?
There's been a series of actions taken by a coalition of organizations in San Diego. Our organization, Pueblo Sin Fronteras, held a rally both outside of Otay Mesa Detention Center and also at the border on the Mexican side of Tijuana. And there's a coalition that's been forming to support detainees in Otay Mesa who were working with the separated families there. They haven't planned an action since the parents were moved to Port Isabel. And so a lot of the actions that I've been aware of have been occurring in McAllen, Texas. But the network of organizations in Otay Mesa continue to hold actions. And they don't have any plan right now that I know of. But they've been focusing on supporting the efforts in Texas and focusing on where the parents actually are right now who are being detained and were taken from their kids.
And I know there's also a lot of expatriates, people who have been deported from the U.S. who now live in Tijuana. Do you know what the census of people who are in Tijuana who actually have been deported? Are they tracking this issue as well?
There are organizations who are tracking the issue in Tijuana, and there's also organizations who are paying attention in Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador, organizations that meet deportees at the border and who are looking to identify people who were separated from their kids. There's a case of somebody from the refugee caravan who unfortunately was deported very soon after being separated from his son. That case is a particularly awful one because this child's mother was murdered not long before he then had to flee Honduras for the same reason. And so his father was an incredibly important emotional support for this child who had lost their mother, and to come to the United States, be torn from the arms of his father, watch his father be cuffed at the wrists and at the ankles and taken away is something that will never, ever, he will never be able to recover from that. I hope that he can grow and in some sense heal from that, but that's the kind of thing that is leaving a scar on the lives of many, many people for reasons of a far-right political agenda.
All right. Well, we thank you for taking the time out, Alex Mensing, and for all the good work that you're doing at the border with Sin Fronteras and this in this movement to protect and try and get these children back with their parents. This is a horrific version of ethnic cleansing with the Trump stamp. The Trump trademark is all over this one. Be careful, Alex. We'll be in touch with you.
Thank you, Alex.
Thank you.
Thanks to both of you. Take care.
All right. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to come back with Lourdes Martinez and Vilma Ortiz. We're going to talk a lot more about this. We'll take a short musical break, and please stay tuned.
If you want to know, it's right there waiting for you.
I think they play a fair amount of her Mister when she was alive. It's sad to say that. There is a fundraiser for undocumented workers. Where can you get more information on this? Oh my gosh. It's a call to action event. It's at a private home, apparently. So, 606 Colorado in Urbana, it's tomorrow, so it might be hard to RSVP, and they are asking for people to do that. I'll get back with you on that. It's through... okay, sorry about that. I better get back.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. I'm here with guest producer Vilma Ortiz. And Vilma has a special guest, and we're going to get into this. Vilma.
Yeah, I'm really excited to be live, joined live in the studio with Lourdes. She's an immigrant from Mexico and mother herself. And she's here today as the political director of Mujeres Unidas y Activas. That, if you don't know, is a fabulous community-based organization of Latina immigrant women. And they work to build community power. They want to have social change. And they are all about justice for women. She's an immigration lawyer, and she has worked as a legal educator. She's trained attorneys on asylum law and all kinds of areas around immigration. So, welcome to Flashpoints.
Thank you.
So, I know that recently you've been in touch with somebody who was just released from the West County Detention Center, and tell us what they heard, what they were told by the officials.
So, we hear that detainees and they're in a state of shock and fear and uncertainty without accurate information. Some of them are being told that they will be transferred within 50 days. When in fact we know that the contract lasts for 120 days, so the deadline most of us are working on the outside is 120 days. They were told they would be transferred out within 50 days, so maybe that's the plan. But this is causing a lot of fear. Some people are being pressured into signing their self-deportation, agreeing with their deportations because they are afraid that these transfers are going to take them to worse places. And I think that is a fear that we share with them, which is one of the reasons that we are demanding that they be released rather than being transferred. They can be put in supervision programs for ICE to stay in touch with them. They can continue to fight their cases in court in the San Francisco Immigration Court. There is no reason to have these immigrants in detention, and we don't want them to be transferred. But what we hear is that inside the West County Detention Facility in Richmond, where ICE has been given 120 days as of the 10th of July to remove everybody who is being held in detention
there. Because
they're
ending the contract. That's
right.
The larger context.
Right. Mm-hmm. That the people detained there are, this is kind of being used abusively against them, you know, to coerce them into signing their own deportations. And also what we hear, and again, I can't confirm that this is happening because it's so difficult to get information. Anyone who knows anyone who's been in detention, it is really difficult to get information out of detention centers. So you get information in the way of almost rumors from people who have families or who know someone inside. But we hear that they are also being told not to waste their money by trying to deposit it into the account where you can then access phone calls outside of the jail, because they won't be able to use it in time because they're going to be transferred out. So again, this is another example of this threat of the transfer now being used against people in detention, dissuading them from making phone calls.
And what is the argument they're giving to not just release these immigrants, since many of them have committed no criminal crime other than not being documented? Why don't they just release them and monitor them instead of taking the time and the extra cost to transfer them to another federal detention facility, maybe very far away?
You know, I think that we could get into a much more in-depth discussion, but really the bottom line answer right now is that this is an ICE agency that has been given a racist mandate. And they have and previously had programs, like I was saying, to stay in touch with people that are in process. For example, people fighting their asylum cases in immigration court. In our communities, like in MUA, everyone knows the famoso grillete, which is this ankle bracelet through which ICE had been keeping track of people electronically so that they could follow their immigration case while remaining with their families, not in jail. And this is now, we're seeing this less and less. I think the pressure on ICE to keep people in detention has increased. And it comes straight from the fact that the Trump administration has a racist policy of detention and deportation, where they are seeing everybody as, they're treating everybody without humanity.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Dennis Bernstein here, delighted to be joined in studio by Vilma Ortiz. She's an attorney. She works at the Women's Building now. She's also a seasoned producer here at KPFA, where we broadcast from. And Lourdes Martinez is an immigrant from Mexico and a mother. She is here today as the political director of Mujeres Unidas y Activas. That's MUA. And they're dealing with this issue firsthand and right where it comes into the community. Now, I think one of the scariest part of this is it's very random. At this point, you could be reunited with your kids and end up in custody being in jail, being held for deportation until you have, an expedited hearing about political asylum, or you could be given a bracelet. It's random. There's no real policy here, right? There's no, people don't know. That's part of the, people don't have the slightest idea what the hell is going to happen, and it really has little to do with the particular background of the people and the family engaged, right?
That's exactly right. Exactly right, Dennis. I think it's, you know, for many, many years I've been working in the field of immigration, hearing from immigrants who have been in detention. And what I experienced as an attorney is exactly what I hear from them, which is that it all comes down to a discretionary decision, sometimes by an individual officer who is dealing with your case. Larger scale, in this case, we're talking about Eric Bonner, the acting field director of ICE, who is the, you know, he is the guy that we are currently, you know, really demanding to release these people because he has the power to make that decision. And even at a different scale, because you mentioned people asking for asylum in court, even that, the application of immigration law, it's in the hands of individual officers reviewing cases. If it's in court, it's the judges. When the judges have to follow, you know, law that has gone all the way to circuit courts, well, different circuit courts say different things about how we are going to apply protections. And so it does feel terribly arbitrary, because it is at many different levels. And you're absolutely right. That means that individuals who are in detention or families outside pleading for their families' cases, we really need the movement. We really need the solidarity of people like your listeners to help us put pressure on these individuals like Eric Bonner to, you know, so that they can feel the pressure of the community. Because ultimately, even though discretionary power acts against us in those cases, if we put pressure on people, on the right people, we might be able to save a few people from deportation.
And in just a minute or two, we're going to talk about that in real terms, because there's a protest planned here in Richmond where people are being held, and there are protests all over the country. Protests are continuing. People are furious. There are sit-ins everywhere. There is civil disobedience everywhere. There are confrontations everywhere, because people do care a lot about it, because groups like the one that you represent and the way in which this happens under the cover, if you will, of the Women's Building, people are fighting back. But I just, before we get to the actions that are coming up here in the Bay Area and some that are happening in other places, I want to ask you, your gut reaction when you saw what this policy was looking like in terms of the real destruction of families, what was going through your mind? How did this hit at heart level?
Thank you for asking that question. I don't know if I can put into words my personal reaction at the time, but I was relieved to hear that thousands of mental health experts and organizations were speaking up about how this this is part of a very dark legacy in the United States, starting with the slave auctions, where slave children were sold and separated from their families, like as if they were not human beings, and Native American children who were also separated from their families in order to be assimilated and acculturated. And of course, something that I've been very moved to see at the actions that I've been attending are people of Japanese descent, people of Jewish descent, talking about how they grew up with stories in their own families about the internment, the Japanese internment camps here in the United States, and of course the Holocaust. So I think that is the best way I can explain the historical context and the human story context that that I feel this fits into.
The brutality of this is all about, obviously, and they stated it. Now they sort of couch it a little bit. But initially, when they introduced this policy of family breaking and deportation and the stealing of children, they said, this is, we're going to make life so tough for you. We're going to make this so painful for you that you're going to leave. You're going to want to leave, you know, back to this concept of self-deportation. The brutality has been quite extraordinary. We did see it before in this country with the Japanese internment. We've seen this before, but it's got a brutal twist here. And it's very clear that you've got an administration that is consciously aware of the idea of ethnic cleansing. They can't face the fact that this is going to be a white minority country soon. And so this is really the last gasp attempt. I mean, imagine Sheriff Arpaio, a convicted felon running for office in a state where he made the people, 30% brown people in that state now who are citizens of the United States. You know, they're voting now. This is a battle going on, but this is, again, the last gasp. So we're going to see a lot of this, and this battle for these children is really part of what it's all about.
Yeah, I want to keep the focus on the children, because I've read some stories about how they are often, even when they are reunited with their families, traumatized, confused, angry. They were told various things by immigration detention officers about why they were left. Sometimes they were lied until their parents weren't coming from them. Many times they were told they told the parent they were going to go give them a bath, or they were asleep and they took the child while the parent was sleeping. Tell us what you know about some of the families and the children and the stories that you may have uncovered in doing some of this work.
Well, one thing I just want to say is that I, again, have been hearing stories for many, many years. And, you know, I remember over 10 years ago visiting a detention center that housed women. And I remember hearing stories of ICE breaking into the house, not exactly breaking into the house, but they moved into the house in that style and pulling a woman out naked in her bed. She was sleeping next to her husband and handcuffing her in that condition. And right there and then removing the people that they arrest from the house, and the children then have to, you know, are left behind. If there's no adult, they also take the children and then figure out what to do with them. And so, you know, as Alex was saying earlier, this has been going on for a while. And I think something that is important for people to understand about the separation of families and the treatment of children, which you are absolutely right, it is causing traumas that will last generations to come. We have heard some, you know, disturbing reports of children being administered drugs to keep them from becoming aggressive or violent because they are experiencing trauma and they're acting up. Mm-hmm. So they are administered drugs as if they were cattle. But one of the things that I'd like for people to understand about the way that separations happen is that I don't know if you all remember hearing about a mass grave found in Texas several years ago, because of people that are found at the border. Yes. The Texas government was just dumping them in this mass grave. There's very little communication with the Mexican government, with the Guatemalan government, when it comes to these things. There's a lot of communication about exchanging arms, stopping the traffic of drugs, and putting pressure on Mexico to get tough on their border in the south. But there's very little communication about, for example, right now, reuniting families. So when parents are deported and they either have U.S. citizen children that are left behind because they were not part of the deportation process, or sometimes what's happened now because of the zero tolerance policy is that some of the children that were separated from their parents were put through the process for unaccompanied minors, which is the term used for children that arrive alone at the border. So once they separated them from their parents, they just pretended their parents did not exist. Mm. And that's a long process, but there are times when the agencies that are then in charge of the children do not find relatives to hand these kids over in the United States. And so these kids sometimes end up in the foster care systems of the states. And if the federal government is not communicating with the, you know, foreign services of countries south of the border, the states much less, right? Mm-hmm. So some of these separations really do lead to lifelong or at least decades-long separations. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the things that we are worried about right now. I don't know if you all heard about the hunger strike happening this past Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. And it is, it started here. It started in Oakland, California. But we are, it's a collective effort of incredibly committed and bold activists, many of them parents, and they are fasting throughout the country. So it started here, but it's been picked up, I believe, now across the country in New York. It will move to Chicago and other places. And so the idea of these amazing activists is that they're going to keep the hunger strike going until families are reunited. And of course, there's so much uncertainty around that because of what I just described. There are families that were separated and the parents have already been deported. And there is no system, there is no process in place to identify who belongs to whom, and much less if the parents have already been deported, because there isn't communication.
That's when we start to think about the way in which the Nazis treated families. This is what begins to come to mind. The internment, and their records are not good enough to get these families back together the way they split them up. That's an extraordinary tragedy that they went that far, that fast, demonstrating an extraordinary brutality. This is why I've been around a while, but this is one of the uglier things I've ever seen in terms of domestic policy in my lifetime. Lourdes, we're really glad to have you here talking with Vilma Ortiz about this. People need to, you know, I refused. I'm going, you know, we've been doing this story every day for the last week, knowing that they were never going to be able to return those kids. And I really think it's the responsibility of every U.S. citizen who knows about this, who isn't in a spaceship on another planet investigating water on Mars, should be standing up.
Absolutely.
For this story. I mean, it really is the heart of the matter, right?
And can I say something,
please,
Dennis? I know that we're going to get into the action that's taking place on the weekend, but I want to say something, and especially speaking to people who have at times questioned, what is the purpose of going to a protest? What is the use? What is the impact that I have? I am so insignificant. I don't think people realize that they have power. And I just want to say, because you brought up the comparison to the Nazis, something that you do hear a lot from U.S. public officials when they're called on this brutality and the inhumanity is that they're just applying the law. They don't make the law. They're just applying the law. I'm just a judge. I'm just an agent. Yeah. I'm just a security guy. Mm-hmm. They are seeing their function as, you know, they don't see their responsibility, or they don't take responsibility. And I think this is where community power is really important. It is important to show up at protests. I don't know if you all heard of the ICE officer who quit and became a whistleblower. This was a San Francisco ICE officer. And the reason that today we are, you know, we're looking at this deadline of reunification of families is because of a judge, a federal judge in Southern California, right? So these are examples of public officials who are taking a stand, but they need the community to be right there behind them, because it takes courage when you're in those situations and you act the way that they have. I think, if I remember correctly, the ICE officer, whose name I'm not remembering right now, but he was intimidated while he was being interviewed. Like, the DHS agents appeared at his door to harass him. So they got caught on camera. But I mean, this is what happens when you take a stand in a state of affairs like this.
They're so used to intimidating people, they'll even intimidate a whistleblower, one of their own. We'll turn to the subject of whistleblowers and people that facilitate the whistles being blown. I realize it's controversial. I'm playing some John Pilger talking about his countryman, Julian Assange, in a little bit. But I did start that announcement about an event tomorrow, 5 to 6. It's actually a supper at a private home. It's a beginning of a fundraiser push to fund Latino Partnerships of Champaign County, a local nonprofit that is creating emergency funds for undocumented people in our town. There's an online campaign at LPCC that's going to be launched on August 6th. And this is a general interest dinner meeting at 606 Colorado. I don't know. I'm kind of uncomfortable going out to, but I thought the root of this dinner meeting, they want to RSVP at ZH Alexander 115. I don't know if this event is cross-listed at the Latino Partnership of Champaign County. I'll check into that. But it's ZH Alexander 115 at gmail.com, and that's your host, Zev, who wants to know about attendees, children, toddlers, dietary things. There's something this afternoon for the youth that looks interesting. And where did that teen workshop at the library? I guess it was mentioned on the show before, Higher Ground, because it includes Aaron Ammons, Urbana City Councilor and candidate for circuit clerk, with a strong message about dealing with voter suppression. This is a project partially of the library and partially of the Illinois Public Media, WLL, our sibling station, I like to say every now and again. Director of Engagement Educational Outreach, Kimberly Kranich, independent media journalist and program director at the IMC, Brian Dolinar, and Cal State Fresno assistant professor, Dr. Amy Rickman, are all at this presentation. It's targeted at ages 13 through 19. Snacks will be served. Again, that's 3 o'clock, hosted by a group I've never heard of before, an interesting name, Localization Allies. Maybe that's a project of WLL. I'm curious. All right. Well, I guess I negated the possibility of playing this incendiary interview with Greg Palast, who's mostly doing work to try to make sure the next election isn't stolen, like all the series of stolen elections we've had in the U.S. through voter suppression and machinations of that sort, which he documents. This is more about his financial understanding. I played it last week on Window in the World and didn't get any flack. I thought I would, because it talks about... Well, my theory of the case is this Trump Jr. Meeting at Trump Towers, one floor below where Donald Trump was at the time. Was he listening in with the Russian lawyer? He got caught in saying he had nothing to do with the meeting and nothing to do with the memo that described the meeting as a nothing burger, talking about the Magnitsky Act, not about providing dirt. My theory of the whole thing is that the dirt that the Russians could easily have access to was Clinton and Clinton Foundation connections to various oligarchic individuals in the periphery of Russia and Russia itself, perhaps. There is an instance in Kazakhstan where ex-President Clinton was a fixer for a deal about uranium. It wasn't the ballyhooed Uranium One deal that everybody people on the right talk about. The problem is that it seems to me that the New York Times and its ilk, and even the Washington Post, which hardly be described really as a liberal output, media, in my opinion, left all of this stuff uninvestigated, and one of the few people would do it be right-wingers and independent journalists like Palast. Palast actually had a Freedom of Information suit for some of those 3,000 emails that were deleted that got so notorious and perhaps still are. But he has chapter and verse on a deal in Kazakhstan that got about $27 million of a fixer fee, quote-unquote, donation. I'm not hating on the Clintons particularly. It's their whole class of people that make their money by servicing the super wealthy, etc. That's really, they're just a symptom of a whole corrupt system, in my opinion. Anyway, I've talked just long enough to hear John Pilger talking about his friend, and I don't know how much he can communicate with him now, Julian Assange. There's a whole event going on this weekend. Deals have been made with Ecuador. Ecuador actually is having a base. I don't know if it's at the Manta base. A U.S. military base is being put back into Ecuador under the curiously named Lenin Moreno. And PhD economics graduate, former U of I attendee, former president of Ecuador, is apparently under house arrest in what looks like a typical kind of retribution kind of attack on your political opposition. I wonder why there's not more talked about our alumni, Rafael Correa, being under house arrest in sort of a trumped-up case, it seems. Okay, yeah. I'll be back with something hopefully fresh tomorrow, though maybe it'll be more on immigration, and maybe The Intercepted will post something by then. They seem to be on a holiday break. There's a chance I might get back to Cy Hirsch. He did some investigation in the aftermath of the Soviet Union and the Clinton-Yeltsin pillage period. That's never really commented much upon, it seems, in the U.S. Here's Dennis Bernstein in a short excerpt from a longer flashpoints from just yesterday, talking about what's going on with WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange.
Thanks for joining us. Let's start off with the latest. What do we know about how Julian Assange is being treated and the state of his being?
Well, the state of his being is pretty much the same, as I understand it. He's not well. He needs medical attention, the kind of diagnostic treatment that you get only in a hospital. But it's been made clear to him that if he attempts to go to hospital, he won't be allowed free passage, and he'll be arrested. So his health isn't good. What do we know about the machinations of a number of governments around the case of a man who, since he was arrested in 2010, has not been charged with a single crime, whose treatment amounts to the most unprecedented persecution? Now, Julian Assange could leave the embassy if his own government, that is the government of his homeland, Australia, applied legitimate diplomatic pressure on behalf of its citizen. There's no question about that in my mind, and we must ask ourselves, why hasn't this happened? My own feeling is that there is a great deal of collusion between the Australian, the British, and the US governments. And the collusion is, in the end, to either close down WikiLeaks completely and or to deliver Julian Assange to the Americans. Recently, the Australian Foreign Minister, Julie Bishop, and senior officials traveled to London and to Washington, and I'm reliably informed they raised the whole matter of Julian, but they raised it in a way that didn't support the whole idea that a government should represent its citizen. It listened, these people listened to the more powerful governments and listened to their intentions of what they had in mind, listened to their evasions. In Washington, where they met Mr. Pompeo, the Secretary of State, as I understand it, he refused to discuss Assange altogether, and this was not challenged. I think there is a collusion that amounts to really attempt to try and do a deal with Julian Assange that he might be allowed out of the embassy, he might be allowed free passage of return to Australia if he shuts down WikiLeaks. I'm not absolutely certain of that, but I think that is very, very likely. And as I understand Julian, that's something he wouldn't even contemplate considering. But that might be one of the so-called wretched deals that are being offered Julian Assange. There's some very strange things being said by senior members of these governments. One of them, the new Foreign Secretary of the United Kingdom, Jeremy Hunt, said, it seemed sarcastically, that the British police would offer Julian a warm welcome, as he put it, when he came out, where he would face serious charges. There are no serious charges. There is a bail infringement, which is far from being a serious. He hasn't been charged with anything. There are no serious charges. Was Hunt referring to a deal that has already been done with the United States on extradition? I don't know. But this is the kind of milieu of pressure and machination around somebody who has the right, basic right, of natural justice, of his freedom. Putting aside freedom of speech, the persecution, the treatment of this man has been something that should horrify all free-thinking peoples. If it doesn't horrify us, then we've surrendered something very, very valuable.
And among those of us who perhaps should be more horrified are our brothers and sisters in the journalistic community. Now, I want to bring Randy in a moment, John, but I also want to put on. I wanted to get into the health and the, and his treatment, but I also want to once again put on the record why Julian Assange is such a significant journalist, why so many international institutions, major journalistic institutions, collaborated, if you will, with him based on the information that he could provide. You name the major news source, the corporate news source, and they ate it up. They've forgotten now. But I think it's important to say we're talking about a publisher, a significant reporter who changed the history of our time. Correct? Is that an overstatement?
No, I don't think it is an overstatement. Nothing in my lifetime as a journalist has equaled the rise of WikiLeaks and the extraordinary impact on journalism. I mean, WikiLeaks is probably the only journalistic organization that has 100% record of accuracy and authenticity. Most of us at some point get something wrong. All of WikiLeaks' revelations have been authentic. Not a single bogus release has happened under WikiLeaks, right across the spectrum. And it's been done without fear or favor, although there's been a concentration on, say, the release of the Hillary Clinton Podesta emails earlier on, the Iraq and Afghan war logs. But WikiLeaks has released information that people have a right to know right across the world. It's released something like 800,000 documents from in Russia. I mean, the irony of this is WikiLeaks has been accused of being an agent of Russia. Laughable accusation, actually. In fact, WikiLeaks has released 800,000 documents, many of which, well, I would suggest most of which, have been revelations of the government in Moscow. Some of them have been used in court cases. WikiLeaks' release of documents, its journalism, has covered a whole universal space. And that's the first time this has happened. So it's given people in many countries, from Tunisia, where the release of WikiLeaks documents foretold unfortunately, the ill-fated Arab Spring, but perhaps not so in Tunisia. That's where it began. And the people at the forefront of the uprising in Tunisia credit the release of WikiLeaks, telling it what its repressive government was doing behind their back. From there to Venezuela, where it released cables by the U.S. ambassador describing in great detail how the United States intended to subvert the government of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, of course, which it tried to do and has tried to do ever since. Information, this is the main point, information that is journalism and that ought to have appeared in newspapers and ought to have been broadcast. Some of it was when there was a collaboration with WikiLeaks. I mean, the Clinton Podesta cables that have seemed to emails, which appear to have made a number of people resentful in the United States, were published in the New York Times with WikiLeaks. And the point about the Podesta emails, that they showed the close role that the Clinton Foundation and Hillary Clinton played in the setting up and the sustenance of extreme jihadism in that part, in the Middle East. That's a very, very important piece of information for people to know and understand. That is almost quintessential journalism. It is telling people something that they would not otherwise know. And for doing that, WikiLeaks has performed an extraordinary public service. And for doing that, of course, it has made some very serious enemies. And Julian Assange is is the target of those people right now, of course.
Voice of John Pilger on yesterday's Flashpoints. Goes on for a while. I don't know how much of the show it is. Flashpoints.net. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared. Again, I'm pointing out that John Pilger has a brilliant short essay about the, was it 1975 constitutional coup where Hoff Whitlam was deposed by the governor general through monarchical edict because he wasn't cooperating with the CIA. It was pretty well CIA engineered, and how that, to my mind, makes an Australian look, particularly Australian leftists, look at the CIA with a pretty jaundiced eye.